tonight on Arena. We talk to the winner of the Dublin Literary Award, Valeria Luselli, and Army of the Dead, The Eighth and The Human Factor are the films up for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Valeria Luselli, author of Lost Children Archive, was announced today as the winner of the Dublin Literary Award for 2021. With a prize of €100,000, it is the world's largest prize for a novel published in English. And I'm delighted that Valeria Luselli joins me on the line. Congratulations, Valeria.
Thank you very much, Kay. I'm very, very happy to be speaking to you. I wish I were in Dublin right now, but yes, I'm happy to be speaking to you, at least.
Indeed, we all do, as would the judges who described your book as a masterpiece that is at once an exhilarating lyrical road novel and an unsparing meditation on dislocation, remembering and storytelling. And I suppose the best way in, Valeria, for our listeners into the novel, The Lost Children Archive, is who are the lost children you refer to?
The lost children are the generations of children, I guess, throughout history that are forced to give up their childhood too soon. Children who have to flee their homes because of war or other forms of political violence. Children who have to stop being children too soon.
Yes, and you got into this story, as the judges refer to there, through a road trip of an unnamed family, of a father and a mother and two children. They're a blended family. The father and son are from one family, and then the mother and daughter, and then the father and mother are married, but they're rather estranged. But they decide to go on a road trip from New York to Arizona. And this reflects a road trip you took yourself.
Well, it reflects many road trips I've taken throughout the US. And it is also the kind of foundational myth of a road trip in this country, right? The displacement from east to west. Just that this particular story of a road trip is almost like an anti-road trip, in the sense that it's not really so much a story of a founding a new nation, which is usually the way that the East-West expansion is told in the USA, but it's the story of the discovery of a country in abandonment and in a state of desolation. And also a story of the current political violence in constant juxtaposition to the historical political violence in the USA against particular communities, primarily against Native Americans and now against other Native Americans of the American continent who migrate here from Central America, seek asylum, and then are, if not deported, placed inside mass detention centers and jails.
Yes, and this and the Ma and Pa, the central couple in the story, who are on this drive from New York to Arizona, they, in their own way, are documenting two different experiences of shame, really, of America, a current shame, which is the immigrant issue on the Mexican border, and then the story of the Native Americans.
That's exactly right. The father in the story is documenting what he calls the echoes of the last group of Native Americans who fought against the U.S. and the Mexican government for their freedom, the Chiricahua Apaches. And at the same time, the mother in the story, who's also the narrator of the story, is documenting the current migration crisis involving a diaspora of children who flee from Central America, from the Northern Triangle in Central America, across Mexico and to the U.S. And at the same time as these two, this husband and wife, mother and father, are documenting these two instances of history, of the dark history of the United States, their own relationship is falling apart, and with it, the family that they have formed is dissolving, right? And so at some point, the story is no longer told by the adult perspective, by her, but by the boy in the back seat of the car, her stepchild.
Yes, and it's a very interesting book for people who are interested in radio as well, because on a road trip, obviously, they're listening to the radio and they're hearing the story of what's happening on the border from radio stations as they pass through the various states. And then they're also sound recorders. They either record stories or the father who's doing this more impressionistic thing of the sounds of where the Apache would have lived. And then there's also, they bring boxes of books or audio books with them. What is the role of all these different source materials in the book?
Right, yes. Well, I am I'm a radio junkie, and I love listening to the radio wherever I am. I like to travel mostly by road. So whenever I'm crossing any landscape, I look for the radio stations, the local radio stations, sometimes just to listen to languages that I don't know, and to listen to voices and stories and music. I think the radio is one of the, for me, the most fascinating medium. And as you well said, the narrator in the story, as is her husband, is a sound documentarist. So the novel itself is a novel that kind of collects sounds, and in writing it, I had to think a lot about the archive, right, and what we put together in a single archive. So the novel both discusses an archive, but is also its own archive. There's kind of interstitial chapters in there called boxes, and those boxes are indeed boxes that travel with the family in the trunk of the car, containing the material that the two adults in the story are using in order to work on their projects. But those boxes are also opened as chapters, and readers can kind of peer into those boxes and see what they contain. And somehow, in looking at what they contain, what they're looking at is the kind of skeleton, the very raw material as well that makes up this particular novel, Lost Children Archive.
Yes, and literature and books and joint projects are something that brought the couple together. And we have an extract here from the book. Here, the mother of the central family we were talking about, the Lost Children Archive, who are on the road trip from New York to Nevada, she recalls when she first met her now estranged husband. And this extract is read by Maddie Joy.
My husband and I met 4 years ago, recording a soundscape of New York City. We were part of a large team of people working for New York University's Center for Urban Science and Progress. The soundscape was meant to collect and sample all the keynotes and sound marks that were emblematic of the city. Subway cars screeching to a halt. Music inside the long underground hallways of 42nd Street. Ministers preaching in Harlem. Bells. Rumors and murmurs inside the Wall Street Stock Exchange. But it also attempted to survey and classify all the other sounds that the city produced and that usually went by as noise, unnoticed. Cash registers opening and closing in delis. A script being rehearsed in an empty Broadway theater. And the water currents in the Hudson. Swinging in Astoria playgrounds. Elderly Korean women filing wealthy fingernails on the Upper West Side. The description of our duties specified. Surveying the most linguistically diverse metropolis on the planet, and mapping the entirety of languages that its adults and children speak. everyone in couples or small groups surveyed and sampled wavelengths around the city, like we were documenting the last sounds of an enormous beast.
A wonderful soundscape there. Maddie Joy reading from Lost Children Archive by Valeria Lucelli, the winner of this year's Dublin Literary Award. Valeria, you worked firsthand with immigrant children when you worked on a project translating their stories in the legal system. And there was two girls, Guatemalan girls, that made their way from the non-fiction book you wrote about this, Tell Me How It Ends, into this fictional story, Lost Children Archive. Could you tell us about the Guatemalan girls?
Yeah, those two girls were some of the first girls that I interviewed in court back in, I guess it was then 2015. They were the youngest kids I had interviewed. In that period, I was working as a volunteer translator, basically gathering testimonies that children gave in order to then write those testimonies in English and send them off to potential lawyers who could then take on their cases and defend them against a deportation order. And those two girls were, I think, 5 and 7 years old. They were really little. They were the youngest kids I'd interviewed in court. And of course, because they were so little, they weren't really able to tell their story and therefore give what the Court of Immigration would consider a convincing case, right? They had no case. And I remember being so frustrated trying to gather as much as I could in order to build a kind of case. But they were really, it was impossible. And it is in so many cases impossible for a child to tell the story in a way that the tell their own story in a way that the court will deem convincing. And so I knew that somehow their case was lost before they even were allowed to give a fight, you know. And I handed some of the notes I'd made over to the lawyer, and the lawyer shook her head as well and said, you know, I don't think we have anything here. And I don't know what happened. To this day, I don't know what happened. I was able to follow through and get updates on many of the other cases because in some of them I stayed on as a translator through the process of applying for asylum and SIDG visas and then some of those kids getting asylum or green cards and so many times I knew the outcome of those stories, and I never knew what happened with those two girls. And so their presence, I guess, has always haunted me deeply. And they are, yeah, they are present in both Tell Me How It Ends, a kind of non-fictional, just an essay about immigration and the immigration system in America. And they're also at the very heart of Lost Children Archive.
Well, congratulations again for winning the Dublin Literary Award with this fantastic book, Lost Children Archive. Valeria Lucelli, thank you so much. And Lost Children Archive is published by Vintage. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena, and Thursday night is Film Review Night. And tonight we have two political documentaries and one zombie drama. The zombie film is Army of the Dead, directed by Zack Snyder, who previously directed Day of the Dead. The first documentary is Irish, The Eighth, covering the vote of the repeal of the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution in 2018. And then we have The Human Factor, a timely documentary on the Arab-Israeli peace talks told from the American negotiator's point of view. Donald Clark and Ruth Barton have been to the virtual cinema for us, and we'll start with Army of the Dead on Netflix, which is part zombie movie, part heist movie. Donald, we'll get to the plot in a moment, but Army of the Dead, Zack Snyder, the director, is no stranger to the zombie film, and he's a big name director with kind of varying success in his various outings.
He is a figure of some controversy, Zack Snyder, we'd have to say, that over the last few years in particular, that he famously had an army of fans resisted the what they regarded as the miscutting of his Justice League film, the DC series, and got behind him and actually persuaded Warner to recut the thing and release it to modest acclaim, rather surprisingly. It ended up being received much better than people had expected. But yeah, he's a noisy, brash director who emerged first with a remake of George Romero's Day of the Dead, way back, Dawn of the Dead, sorry, way back about over a decade ago. And that was, to everyone's surprise, really promising. It's not a film that we felt needed remaking. It was a classic in its own right. And everyone thought, oh, here's a flash new director who's really going to take the take genres for filmmaking by the neck and give us something new and exciting. And he kind of did with 300, and then he went way off the beam with a really dull version of Watchmen, the iconic comic, and the really dull, bleak DC stuff. So he hasn't got a great critical reputation, but I thought this was a return to form, if you believe that Zack has form to return to. His aesthetic has always been that of a five-year-old hopped up on industrial strength tartrazine. Mostly that's bad. I mean, you feel a bit like an overstressed parent watching these things. But when he gets the right project, as he did way back then with 300, and way back with the remake of Dawn of the Dead, then it can be fun for a while. Maybe not quite for the well over 2 hours we're offered here, but there really was enough revolting invention here for me to keep me diverted. And okay, he unquestionably does have a gift for dynamic, cartoonish invention. It's also a good concept. Now, looking at it, I kind of feel that somewhere out there, some exploitation director must have done this before, but this is certainly the first time it's come to a big budget production, in this case big budget production for Netflix, people who have all their money. Dave Bautista, former wrestler, a very charismatic actor, and the following on from the tradition of the Schwarzeneggers of the world, plays one of the party of hard men and hard women tasked with breaking into a zombie infested Las Vegas and robbing stacks of money. So essentially it's Escape from New York, and it's Ocean's 11, and it's Dawn of the Dead, so it's Escape from Ocean's 11 of the Dead, which suits me fine.
Okay, and Ruth, tell us, how did the zombies take over Las Vegas?
Well, I'm glad you're not asking me for the entire plot, because that would take us to tomorrow. But there is a pre-credit sequence where a military convoy is accompanying a container. They have an accident on the highway, everything bursts into flames, the container spills open, they're told to keep away from it, but like Pandora's box, they don't. And too late, out leaps a massive human-chewing zombie. And I mean, it's, you know, people are very disposable in this movie, so it's not spoiling anything to say that they're munched ab initio, and then they turn into munchers, because that's what happens when you're bitten by a zombie.
Okay, well, then, as Donald says, it turns into a heist movie, because there's a whole heap of money laying in wait in Las Vegas before the government decide to nuke Las Vegas and all the zombies. So Dave Bautista, as Scott Ward, has put a crew together for a big heist in the zombie-hidden Las Vegas. Here himself and Maria, played by Ana de Rugeira, recruit Tig Notaro as the pilot, Marianne.
We are putting together a crew for a job.
Yeah, what does it pay?
If it pans out, you make $2 million for one day's work.
$2 million?
But
that's my share. That's just for me. $2 million if it pans out. 100% I'm in. Yeah.
You don't want to know, you know, the risks, or?
Why would I want to know the risks? $2 million? It's a lot of cash. Listen, I hate my life so deeply. If I had $2 million, my life would change drastically. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
You sure you don't want to know?
I bet it has something to do with a helicopter.
Yeah.
I'm the helicopter guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where do I sign?
Okay, so we get the idea from there. The zombies are corralled in Las Vegas, but the vault that the task force want to get their hands on is in Las Vegas as well. Is our sympathy definitely with Scott and his crew and not with the zombies, Donald?
Oh, that's a kind of existential question about the history of the zombie film. To what extent we're allowed to feel or invited to feel any sympathy for zombies down through the years. I don't think we are. I think one of the things that is eerie about zombies, and I wouldn't want to give this film too much credit because it's it is high on, full on high energy from the get-go, and there's not much space left for contemplation. But I think from the beginning, and when I say from the beginning, I don't mean going back to I Walked with a Zombie in the 40s, the Val Lewton films. I mean from George Romero in the 60s, who incidentally initially never thought of his characters as zombies. They thought of them as ghouls, and they became called zombies. I think what's one of the things that's frightening about them is that they are not human. Is that there is a notion about the zombie as defined by those films, that they reduce the human being to a machine, that all that's left of us are the things that push us forward, and a residual level of desire and familiarity for things that we enjoyed and appreciated and made us feel comfortable when we were human. I think that is quite an eerie notion. It's some ways eerier than the vampire, which is always kind of has got a layer of glamour plastered over it. I think that notion that we're just these kind of shuffling machines who, if we can somehow get past the notion that we're mortal, we'll keep on shuffling after our petty desires after we die. But no, to answer your question, no, there's no sympathy here, I don't think, for the zombie, whatever has been.
And I think if anybody listens to the next clip, they'll know there's no complications subtext. Here we have the pedantic perfectionist Dieter, played by Matthias Schuhhofer, and he asks a pertinent question.
How precisely do we do the zombie killing?
Oh, Jesus. Is there anybody else here who hasn't killed a zombie? Well, we all know the basics. Zombies, shamblers, the undead, whatever you want to call them. When it comes to killing them, it's all about the brain. If one comes at you, shoot it in the brain. It's that simple. Any questions?
Yes. What if I took a big rock and smashed it into the head? Would that work?
Yeah. Yeah, that'd still be targeting the brain, so that would work.
Copy that.
Okay, Ruth, how did it work for you, this mix of a mashup between a zombie and a heist movie?
Well, this for me was a movie that had a very sharp rock to the brain. I thought it was that exchange just is part of the problem, because any time that Schneider tries to write dialogue, everything has to stop as he fumbles with his keyboard. And there is just, you know, there's no rapport between the characters. I mean, they're all going to be zombies at the end of the day, so who cares? So for me, it was, okay, smash, bam, wham. You know, it's really sort of video game aesthetic. It's got a kind of angsty feel about the end of the world. But then again, you know, other movies do too. So I thought it was 2.5 hours of absolute tedium, and loud and long and pointless. But I did admire its visuals to some extent. So I gave it 2 for visuals and 0 for everything else. It's a 2 out of 5.
And for you, Donald?
I'll give it 3.5. I liked it. I had a good time.
Oh, lucky you.
Excellent. 3.5 and 2 out of 5 for what's it called again? Army of the Dead.
Anything.
Yes.
What else could it be called?
Army of the Dead. So next to the documentary The Eighth, released on the 3rd anniversary of the vote to repeal the 8th Amendment to the Irish Constitution, the film from the directors Aideen Kane, Lucy Kennedy and Maeve O'Boyle tells the story of the landmark referendum and Ireland's history with abortion, which brought us to the point of repeal in May 2018. Donald, this documentary does clearly have a pro-repeal perspective, doesn't it, focusing as it does on the Yes campaigners like Alva Smith and Andrea Horan. But the No side is represented. Are they given equal space, or is there a strong bias?
No, I mean, they're not given equal space. It is quite clear the direction from which they're coming in this film. But that's fine. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't say that in any way a criticism. I mean, it's the nature of documentary filmmaking that it's impossible not to take a position in some regard. And I think some people approaching this film may, despite the fact that it's quite clear where the filmmakers stand in general terms on the campaign, I think some people coming to this film might actually be a little bit surprised, but still having said what I said, how much time they do give to the Yes campaign. And I think a lot of those arguments are framed in very respectful fashion. That, you know, they don't cut out kind of like bits that might be construed as being crazy or, you know, kind of or reactionary. They have Wendy Grace appears, who's a broadcaster on Spirit Radio, I think, and yes. She talks about her wider worries with some articulacy. The ever ubiquitous John McGurk is there, who's communications director of Save the Eighth. He gets interviewed and he's given time to make his points. And there's also archival footage of people like Maria Steen coming through. So yes, I think they do allow those voices to come through to a certain extent. And they also, I think, are quite honest about how they interrogate the strategies that the Yes campaign had to pursue in order to give them the best chance of winning.
Okay.
It admits this was a political campaign and not just a gesture where people stood up and spoke honestly about their feelings and about what they felt was the right thing to do.
Yes, I'll come back to the strategies in a moment. I just wanted to give some of the drama of the piece. Here's a reminder of what it was like during the 2018 campaign. Alva Smith addresses a repeal rally and it gets contentious.
Not the church, not the state.
Women must decide their fate.
Hey, hey, mister.
Get your balls off our sister.
Hey, hey, mister.
Get your balls off our
I have to say, starting here in front of you now, and as I was coming down on Connie Street, I was truly overwhelmed with very profound emotion. With emotion which is very
it's
real.
Warda, can you not see it's Warda?
A very heated scene there from the Eighth, a documentary on the 2018 campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment. Going back to what Donald just touched on there about the campaign strategizing, was it clear from both camps what strategy they decided to take in terms of trying to sell their message to the wider public? Ruth?
Yes, I thought this was one of the really interesting parts of the film, which is they do cut between both campaign headquarters, so they cut, you know, between the repealers and the savers, and just as Donald was saying, what seemed to kind of roll along in a very organic manner, you now realise was very, very orchestrated. And the debate that both sides have to kind of contemplate and deal with is the really pressing and kind of horrific stories that emerge of women who lose their lives or have to travel for an abortion when they know that the baby will never be born alive. So, you know, people with an already terminated pregnancy, if you like. So those are, in fact, as both sides realise, those are the cases that really make a point, but they are also not the cases that are going to bring out the wider population. So they have to work around the what they call the hard cases, which is these awful stories. And of course they pick up on the Savita Halappanava story, which is just so unbearable. But the debate is to what extent they focus on those and to what extent they move into the wider issue and the wider populace, and then you get into belief rather than medicine and ideas of the kind of limits of the body, and also quite interesting legal arguments, because the term unborn isn't it isn't a noun, so how can it be a thing? And so these are quite interesting. So it's not all about the kind of emotional impact that seems to come through when you watch the footage, but it is about the kind of strategies, the thoughts, and also, of course, the history behind all of this.
As Donald was saying, there are key people that the story is told through, and Alva Smith of the Yes campaign is the key person, really. And in this clip, she talks about her life and her struggle before she discovered the women's movement.
It wasn't until I was a young woman going to work and then, you know, getting married and so on, that I began to kind of become aware there were contradictory expectations, that I would be this perfectly formed middle-class wife and mother while at the same time achieving extensive career goals. as soon as I got married, it became very clear that I was really quite ill. I had very severe anorexia nervosa, and that was accompanied by, again, very typically, by quite severe depression. It was an evasion strategy. The only way I could really do this was to be no more, was to diminish myself to the point of being nothing, where, you know, I would be so thin. I didn't even think of being thin. These are my words now, you know, 50-something years later, that I would be so little, so small, that I wouldn't be seen and therefore couldn't be pulled apart anymore, couldn't be controlled anymore. There would only just be that tiny little spark of me left that nothing more could be done to. It was almost like getting rid of the woman that I was supposed to be. And then a period of not knowing who I was or not knowing who I could be. So in my very fortunate case, the women's movement was there, and I could see that this is the kind of woman you could be.
There, Alva Smith from The Eighth, the documentary we're discussing here with Donald Clark and Ruth Barton. Donald, as storytellers, how do you think the directors approach this? Because there's a long history going back to the 80s of the First Amendment. How did they tell the story and present it to us?
Extremely well would be the short phrase I would use. When I saw this at a Galway Film Flat, well, not actually at the Galway Film Flat, like everything else last year, it was actually on my sofa. But when I saw it, and virtually at the Galway Film Flat, I thought, well, I'm obviously well disposed towards this, but I've heard enough. You know, we've all heard enough over the last 2 years, and particularly that year itself, 2018. But they managed to prove me wrong. They really make a really compelling story, despite the fact that a lot of the information that I've heard before. And part of their genius, if I use that word here, is how eloquently they weave the historical information in with the contemporaneous footage, the footage of the campaign itself. The story, obviously the story goes back, you know, hundreds of years, but the story essentially is framed as starting in 1983 when the amendment was placed in the Constitution. And there's some footage back then. I mean, for those of us who can remember that far back, God, Ireland looked like a dreary place in those days. We have a great deal of social problems now, but and just the notion of of how people talked about women in those days and how they talked about abortion was enormously depressing. So you get that, and then you get, and also you have very lucid explanation of these. You've got people like Ivana Bacic, who obviously is a distinguished legal scholar, is there amongst others to talk us through the basis of these in very lucid, terse, clear terms that filled in a number of legal and political blanks that I had forgotten about or was never aware of. So you get that, you get the X case, obviously, is another significant part in this argument. Then, you know, you move forward to towards the campaign itself, which begins with a real sense of trepidation. There is that sense that people think, well, you know, the polls look to be going in our direction, but the polls always narrow when in referenda and so forth. And so that forms a narrative in itself, even though obviously you know how it's going to end. But I think the way they weave those two things together, the way they insert the historical aspects throughout the contemporaneous aspect, is very, very skillfully done. It never flags. It's just the right length. They could, I'm sure, have made this 2 hours, 3 hours long, but at an hour and a half, it never flags.
And for stars out of five from you, Donald?
I'm going to go 5 stars. I really thought I couldn't see how it could have been better done.
Right. Ruth, would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, initially I thought 4 because I was disconcerted not to when the politicians popped up at the end. I hadn't been in it at all. And then I thought, actually, that's totally right because they were a flash in the pan in the story. But I did love that moment where you get the poster saying, I fancy Simon Harris. And I thought, oh, God, that's history. Five.
Okay, so 5 out of 5 from Ruth and Donald for The Eighth. And finally, to The Human Factor, a documentary from Dror Murray on the role played by successive US administrations in the Arab-Israeli peace process. Ruth, this is very much a topical issue at the moment. Can you tell us a little bit about the point of view of this feature?
Yes, it's startlingly contemporary, this documentary, and it's really, really worth watching just because of what's in the news at the moment, and particularly because we waited so long for Joe Biden and the Americans to show their hand this time round, this, you know, latest set of atrocities. But what this is, it is about the American attempts to broker peace between the main sides, but principally between the Israelis and the Palestinians in the period from 1991 onwards, where you get the end of the Cold War and the focus moves to the Middle East, and you have a real, you know, belief that you can solve the problem. And so it's a straightforward Talking Heads documentary, but the Talking Heads are all on the American negotiating team. And so these are now men who are quite senior in age, in rank, in fact, essentially retired. And they remember all the various moves that went on at the time. In particular, the real focus is on the Clinton administration, because Clinton basically inherits the Middle East situation. And he believes, and he kind of fools himself, really deludes himself through hubris into believing that he can resolve the problem. These talking heads, these American negotiators, very skillful, very erudite, very civilized men, talk us through the history of the negotiations. But then as the documentary evolves, you realize they're also being nudged to question themselves and to question the process and to ask, was peace ever possible?
But Donald, there is a huge sense of hope, isn't there? Especially when Clinton is in power and Yitzhak Rabin is the Prime Minister of Israel, and he and Yasser Arafat really develop a rapport. I mean, we don't know where it was going to go, because the tragedy was, of course, that Rabin was assassinated. But there is a real sense of hope, and then that devastation of hope in the documentary.
Yes, and they're quite skilled in maintaining a degree of tension, even though, as we said about the 8th before, we know where it's going to end up. By golly, do we know where it's going to end up? And I think they do that quite effectively. So, as you say, it seems at points like that, you do feel yourself being dragged into the spirit of optimism that carries the Americans along. It's a strange sort of film. I mean, I don't think it's quite as successful as the director's The Gatekeepers from a few years back, which is about the Israeli Secret Service, for a few reasons. I mean, I think, firstly, a number of faces are obviously missing. I mean, I don't know if he decided not to ask Clinton, for example, to contribute, or any of the other real top brass to contribute.
Do you think they asked?
I don't know. I literally don't know. So, I mean, I haven't actually found that information out. But certainly I feel that they seem missing, given that people like Clinton are still upright and in good health and could be there if they wish to.
Yes.
And I think that notion of it, I think earlier on, I think they should have addressed the fact, they should have analysed the fact that this is a history of the negotiations as a history of the American involvement in the negotiations, because that is very important. I mean, somebody does eventually, a long way into the film, admit that the US has always essentially acted as Israeli's lawyer, which is an interesting phrase, in these talks, that they clarify the proposals from that country and then take them to the other side. And I think that needed to be said earlier, because to that point, you're thinking, like, well, this isn't really a history of the negotiations. It's a history of that American involvement. But all that said, and that whinged about, also one thing I would say, the technical thing, they need to put the job titles of the people on the screen. I mean, this seemed to be it's a tiny thing, I know, but just a technical thing, is when you're dealing with a documentary that has no voiceover, I kept saying, who are you? And no, I mean, I actually found myself looking up Wikipedia, looking up Google to find out who these people were. You need to do that. That's a small thing.
There's also an interesting clip here I just want to play, Donald.
Sure.
This is when the filmmaker asks the key people, that's Dennis Ross and Aaron David Miller, about their Jewishness and what role they think or bias that might bring to the proceedings.
Dennis, you're Jewish.
I am.
Now, beside Gamal, all the negotiating team are Jews.
Yes.
How do you think this is perceived by the other side, as you are supposed to be unbiased?
Well, I think it's easy for them to portray us as being one-sided when they look at all the negotiators as being Jewish. Now, the reality is, it was also each of those people who was Jewish who carried the greatest passion about wanting to see this settled.
But you are biased. You are biased. In a way, you are biased. You say yourself.
But you know what? But that's the notion that mediators have to be, quote, perfectly neutral. The only people who say that have never done any mediation of any hard issue.
I'm not an observant Jew. I was raised in a very traditional, conservative Jewish household. I don't think I, or anyone, frankly, who's ever worked on this process, is free from the prejudgments and prejudices and biases. You are the sum total of your experiences. The downside is that you grow up in a milieu and an environment in which you're much more familiar with the needs and requirements of one side, but not the other.
So that's Dennis Ross and Aaron David Miller there talking in The Human Factor about telling really the Arab-Israeli 1990s peace process from the American point of view. Ruth, there are interesting insights about Arafat. And I think it's Dennis Ross, isn't it, when he visits them and meets some of the PLO while he's waiting for Arafat. And they're watching an unusual television programme.
Yeah, I love this detail. There are some lovely details. Their favourite programme is The Golden Girls. And you see them all sitting around the television watching it. And this is where, you know, these guys are terrific, because this another of the details that I really enjoyed was this issue around wearing a suit. And Rabin insists that when they go to the one of the early negotiations, that he's going to wear a suit, and therefore Arafat must wear a suit. Arafat says, "I don't wear a suit." And he turns up in his combat gear. So the Americans say, "Oh, no, that's okay. Arafat's wearing a safari suit." And everybody says, "Oh, that's okay." And they walk in to the negotiation. So I think it's called The Human Factor. And this is The Human Factor. And it's these teeny breakthroughs where they see the humanity of the people who are negotiating. We see the humanity of the people that really draw us into this film.
Yeah, Donald, there's another scene where it's a great tip for a handshake when I think it's Arafat, they think, will just kiss everybody. And obviously, Rabin doesn't want to be kissed by Arafat. So they rehearse with Clinton how to shake hands.
Oh, the politics of gesture and the politics of greeting are woven all the way through that. And that's an example of what I think the film is best about, which is less about the dynamics of this particular situation, because they've obviously decided they can't really discuss in too great depth the political and moral difficulties, questions, I should say, in this dispute, because there's just no space for it. I mean, that's a whole different documentary. This is a documentary about the process of negotiation. And I think that's a good example of how good it is on the process of negotiation. There's another good point where we see that the U.S. prematurely reveals a concession on the Golan Heights, and they talk through, "Oh, no, that was something that we were going to give, but that was supposed to be kept in the pocket," is the phrase that they use, "until the right moment." So it was going to happen, but it had to happen at the right time. I think it's very good on those sort of things. As you were saying, and those the Golden Girls things and the suit thing, all that, those tiny details are also terrific.
Yes, and for the Irish colour. People, we are, of course, a parallel in our heads. We're thinking of what was happening during our own peace process around the same time. So stars out of five for you, Donald.
Four.
Four out of five for The Human Factor, and from you, Ruth.
Yeah, four out of five too. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, I think it's very good. The Human Factor is on IFI at Home. The 8th is released on demand next Tuesday. And Army of the Dead is available on Netflix from tomorrow. It's just coming up on 8 minutes to eight. The Galway Early Music Festival celebrates its 25th anniversary festival this weekend with online concerts and events. It offers a wide range of music, including 17th and 18th century Italian repertoire, Handel and Rameau arias, the songs of the Crusades and Bach, as well as 17th century German repertoire. Central to the weekend is also an exploration of Irish music across 300 years of culture. And tomorrow evening at 8 p.m, Irish and Italian Renaissance harpist Siobhan Armstrong directs the Irish Consort in a programme entitled Saints, Heroes and Knights, all streamed from the Mictlally Theatre in the heart of medieval Galway, featuring some of Ireland's finest early music performers and musicians. And Siobhan Armstrong joins me now. Siobhan, first of all, the title of the festival, Galway Early Music. What do you mean by early music?
Hi, Kay. It's lovely to chat to you.
You too.
Well, one wag asked me once, they said, oh, early music, is that what you play before your breakfast in the morning? And no, that's not what early music is. When we say early music, those of us who play it, we mean old music from long ago. And often we're playing it on instruments, copies of instruments from long ago that may have died out, or they may have morphed into their modern equivalents, like the early Irish harp versus the modern Irish harp, because I play the older one, it's a bit different. So early music is music from long ago.
Right.
But music which was very lively for them and remains lively for those of us who still love it.
And, you know, I mentioned Bach and Handel there. Are they early music? No.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they are. So both of them are born in the 17th century and they die in the 18th century. And so that's quite far removed from us now. And so the instruments that they played and their whole aesthetic, how they thought about music and their whole social world was very different to ours. So it's a completely, you know, the past is another place. They did things differently there. So that this would apply, I think, for the music as well.
Now, there's a piece entitled Limerick's Lamentation. And we're back now in Cromwellian times. Post-Cromwell,
well, it's 1691. Century, yes. So this is a little bit post-Cromwell. You're right. We'd suffered from Cromwell in the 1640s, and now we were getting to suffer again in the 1690s. So there's always some battle going on.
Okay, so this is the Battle of the Boyne, is it, that we're talking about, and down to the Siege of Limerick?
That's right. It's the culmination of, because you asked me about the title of the whole festival, and the title of my own programme is Saints, Heroes and Kings. So this would be about the kings, James I and William of Orange, who were battling each other for the English throne. And of course, their battles came over into Ireland. And so after the Battle of the Boyne, you had the disaster at Ockram and you had two sieges at Limerick. And this beautiful piece, this extraordinary melody, is at the end of the siege of Limerick, when all is lost and all the battles are finally have not gone our way. And so this commemorates our final loss in 1691.
And we're listening to Ronan Brown on whistle here and Malachy Robinson on bass violin. So that's Limerick's Lamentation there. So that's Malachy Robinson on bass viol and Ronan Brown there on whistle.
That's right.
And I'm talking to Siobhan Armstrong. That's a beautiful lament.
Isn't it just extraordinary? You feel the heartbreak of a whole civilization on its knees at that point.
Now, tell us a little about the Irish Consort, the group of musicians you are directing tomorrow evening.
So I put the consort together to present the different sound worlds that were heard in Ireland historically, as sort of a them and us, if you will, the vernacular Irish, and then the colonists who appear every century and their descendants down through the centuries. So I play Renaissance and Baroque chamber music and opera outside Ireland, but inside Ireland, or here, I tend to promote the early Irish harp, that wonderful instrument that we played for nearly 800 years, but it died out at the beginning of the 19th century. So the Irish Consort is all about excavating and finding all of those old instruments and the old music and old sources of both sides of the coin. So our vernacular music, our traditional music, and then what were the Tudors playing when they went home after all the battles in the evenings? What were the aristocratic Tudors listening to? And what was O'Neill and O'Donnell? What were they listening to when they retired? So the Irish Consort is all about excavating and recreating that sound world that has been lost in the years before 1600.
So that's why you're bringing together the Irish traditional musicians, because presumably that's what the great chieftains of Ireland might have been listening to, and then the European early music practitioners, which might have been more what the Tudors were listening to. Or is that too
simplistic? That's it, exactly.
All right. Okay.
That's it, exactly. So the Tudors brought European instruments with them, these bowed bass instruments or smaller instruments called viols, and they brought their lutes and their harpsichords. But of course, the Irish chieftains had bardic poetry, and they had their harpers, and they had their very sophisticated music world as well. But the two were completely different, but they overlap in a really interesting way. And this is what this program explores. So it explores, for example, an Irish harper who went to London, who was the first royal Irish harper at the English court in London, Cormac MacDermot, at the turn of the 17th century. So what was he playing? And so I've reconstructed his music for the viols and the harp so that we can hear the very first European music composed by an Irishman that survived. So that's just another aspect of the programme.
And this is what we're listening to now. This is An Alman by Cormac MacDermot. There's Siobhan Armstrong on the harp. And Siobhan Armstrong, thank you so much. The Saints, Heroes and Kings Concerts takes place tomorrow evening at the Galway Early Music Festival, and that runs from the 21st to the 23rd of May. Further details are at galwayearlymusic.com. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Jamie Doyle was on sound. Daniel Keating was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Olam McGowan.